Welcome back to the Narrative Monopoly Podcast. On today's episode, we have my friend, Max Tuohy. Max is one of the founders of Roka News. We talk all about it. It's one of the most exciting new news startups, in my opinion. What they're doing is honestly something that a lot of people clamor for in terms of bringing down the temperature of news. And they've been excellent in terms of executing on their vision. They started out with a full news platform and then pivoted just to Instagram. And we recorded this a couple months ago, and just the scheduling didn't work out right where couldn't release it right away. But I'm happy that we actually waited to release this one, because the number that's in there, I think it was 300,000 or 400,000, is pales in comparison to where they're at now. I think they're at almost 650,000 Instagram subscribers, and they are just adding them like wildfire. I think this is under 6 months it took them to accumulate that, and the engagement is huge. So they are a company to watch in the news space. Absolutely. It's just him and his other two co-founders doing everything. So it's great. We talk about that. We get into other issues, a little controversial at times, not too controversial in my opinion, but overall, it is a great episode, and without further ado, let's press play. All right, on today's podcast, we have one of the most interesting men in the media who will soon be a household name, in my opinion, and his name is Max Tuohy. How are you, Max?
Jeff, I'm pumped to be on Narrative Monopoly.
Thanks for coming on. So you have just founded Roka News recently. I guess it actually is probably about a year now, right?
Well, we came up with the idea almost exactly a year ago, but we officially launched in late August. So just over 8 months since going live.
Great, great. So why don't we give the audience a little introduction to you? And then we'll get into the origin story of Roka, but it's Ride the News. If someone is curious right now and they wanna switch to Instagram at Ride the News, and then you're gonna get some context on what's about to come in this conversation.
Exactly, we have a great newsletter too. So check out the bio, sign up for that if you're of the newsletter variety.
All right, so let's get the Max Tuohy story first.
Let's go. So Jeff, I went to Notre Dame for college, and after college, I came to work in DC in the political space and at a think tank at the American Enterprise Institute. And while there, I hosted a podcast called Banter, which was, it was fundamentally my co-host Max Frost and I and Matt Wines, that we had a third co-host. We would basically talk to people we found really interesting about issues that people really care about. So things like college campus, free speech, immigration, a healthy mix of culture and political issues. And this was just such an energizing experience, because I always loved politics. I loved media generally. And we had a blast doing it. So a few months into it, pandemic hit. And so all of a sudden, all the in-person interviews go remote, and we're getting deeper into the media.
This is for Banter.
This is for Banter. Exactly. And so at this point, we're like, this is when the Max Tuohy stories becomes the Roka story. We had such a passion about the media space, such a passion about the world of ideas. And this is when COVID news coverage became so clearly alarmist, so clearly fear-mongering. And that's when we were like, you know what? We want to throw our hat into the ring. We obviously, as young people, feel the news is incredibly out of touch. We think it's incredibly partisan, negative, alarmist. And so it reached a fever pitch of, holy shit, the news is awful. It's completely out of touch. Let's think about starting something. We've always had entrepreneurial minds. So That's when Roku News first was conceived, was April of 2020. I'm so eager to talk about Roku News that I quickly ditched the personal story to go into that origin. But yeah, I'm just a guy, come from a family of five kids, middle child, moved around a lot growing up, love sports, love comedy, love movies, love a lot of normal things. I consider myself, my interest, to be a normal guy.
So you were, you know, hosting banter and, you know, the itch started to come on that you had to scratch to start Roka. What was that itch specifically? What was the problem that you saw that made you make the jump?
It really was a mix between what I thought was an incredible business opportunity with more of an ideological calling. So the incredible business opportunity was you have an industry overrun by baby boomer executives who are completely out of touch with the form of content people like to get, especially millennials and Zoomers, and also the content. So they're focusing on very inside DC Beltway, the news space I'm speaking of, DC insider Beltway, inside Beltway, Capitol Hill, congressional issues that most people don't care about. And also oversee regime changes, interest rate changes. When you look at it, the New York Times front page or say Politico's front page, it's very much an insider game where if you miss, here's a complaint you hear in research a lot from people of our generation, Jeff, is if you miss the first 8 episodes of a given story, you're lost. It's like hopping into a TV show at episode 10, you're done. And so there is A, that level of inaccessibility. B, they're still running news in 800 word long form articles with a lot of jargon in website format, which is what Zoomers and millennials no longer go on. You know, everybody spends their time on social media, on YouTube. And so why not meet people where they are in a realistic way instead of being stuck with journalist practices and tradition, which is clearly not serving people and clearly not reaching young people where they are. So I thought there was an incredible business opportunity to say, why not focus more on interesting issues and also reach people where they are in a format that's quick, that's convenient, that doesn't use jargon, that provides context, all these, you know, more of a business opportunity. Now, ideological aspect. I think the media is, and I'm glad public polling now reflects this, that other people feel this way, is the most divisive institution in the country right now. I think they pursue narratives at the expense of facts and stories. They pick stories they cover based on narratives. And ultimately, people leave their, whether it's a cable news program or an online outlet or a print newspaper, they leave feeling angry. And that's how these news companies make their money. They raise people's blood pressure. They use alarmist titles. They pick stories that are tragic. They'll never cover the good side of the story, even if they covered the bad side 1 week prior. And ultimately, it leaves people feeling angry. And the world's far too interesting, and the country's far too divisive or divided right now for that thing to be healthy for our country. And it just reached a fever pitch of frustration last year when if there were every day the world is ending headlines, the death tracker on COVID on CNN, the New York Times saying, here are some things we'll never do again after the pandemic. Shake hands, hug, attend outdoor sporting events. All these things that were just so out of touch with what people want to do with their lives, normal people. And it became such an insider, coastal elite industry, I think the news industry again. And that just was so frustrating because nobody wants a country to be divided. I personally, you know, so many friends on both sides. My family's on both sides. I'm tired of this blue versus red. Why not have something that, and I think the news plays a devastating role in all that.
Yeah, I do think that you guys have done a good job in terms of shading out all of the things that you just talked about. If you go on to Roka's Instagram page, which is your main distribution vehicle, along with the newsletter, which we'll get into how you came to that choice. You know, it really doesn't raise the blood pressure. There aren't these grand narratives. You can tell that, you know, you guys aren't trying to tug anyone one way or the other. You're just trying to get information out there. And I think the other thing is the story selection is what you touched on. I think you guys choose really interesting stories that aren't necessarily what you're talking about, this insider game. To go back, one thing that you just talked about was how I think boomers have basically just ported over a newspaper story from print into the web. So if you talk about like the 800 word story, it's really just not necessary. I have personally made a habit of anytime I see an article with a headline that, you know, purports to tell me something, I always skip to the second or third paragraph just immediately. And I 99% of the time, I don't miss anything because the answer is somewhere there in the middle. In terms of playing the elite game, I mean, what do you exactly mean by that? Do you mean that they're kind of like talking to each other and that the news is not necessarily a reflection of what is the most important, but is what is most important internally inside these elite circles is what you're saying?
Oh, I think it's a combination. I think it's both an HR question of who works at these prominent outlets and then consequential of that, but also I think it was independent. I think it's a bit of a chicken and egg. It's you know, the content they cover is very insider, coastal elite, and not relevant to people's everyday lives. So on the first point, when you look at the roster of opinion columnists at the big three newspapers, and when you look at the average reporter at even some of the digital native outlets like Axios and Vox, these tend to be Northeastern. A lot of people went to Columbia Journalism School. They're of an ilk. And of course, there's also, politically speaking, they are heavily left-leaning. And there's no secret about that. You can go through the New York Times, for example, a columnist list. They have 15 columnists. And there are about three that are either center-right, Bret Stephens, Ross Douthat, and if you want to be generous, David Brooks. The rest are very much lefty. Not one of the three columnists was at all, supportive of Trump in any way. So they were all, left on that. And I think they were, what's true there, and that, by the way, is no political statement on my part. That's just to say these people aren't representative of the country. And if you're someone who believes the intelligentsia can't be representative of the country because they're an enlightened few, then sure, that supports your case. There's no need to be representative of the country. But I think I believe, and I think a lot of people believe, that the average American is smart, that they're passionate, that they can figure things out themselves, and they don't need the explanatory journalism that you get in most places, where it's no longer about presenting facts and quotes and stories. It's now about narrative spinning every single set of facts and quotes and stories to fit a larger agenda. So I think specifically to get back to your question about what this looks like for the elites, I think they're more likely to cover issues that are very much relevant to them. What I mean by that is, for example, there's been a concerted effort to focus on issues of identity politics and part of the larger commitment to social justice. And now a lot of the stories that are front page worthy at these outlets are simply about, they could be about an eighth grade teacher in Iowa who did something that, who said something that was allegedly racist or did something that was inappropriate. And all of a sudden, instead of speaking up to power, they're speaking down to and capturing stories kind of like, a net in, taking a fish out of water around the country, to fit this larger narrative. And that's not just what they're doing. I know that's just one slice of this issue they focus on. But the point there is, it really is, they pick an agenda, they find stories to meet that. And those stories don't even have to be the most relevant to the average person. It has to be what interests them and what fits that agenda they picked.
I really like the idea of reaching out to the average person. Specifically around story selection, I think that the history is clear that journalism used to be, at least in the mid 20th century, more of a blue collar job, and there were obviously newspapers in every city that were booming and that Americans got at their door every single day. And that is obviously not the case anymore, especially with these subscription numbers of the New York Times specifically. I mean, that comes at the cost. I think Ben Smith, the New York Times media reporter, has even said this openly. That comes at the cost of something like the Dayton Daily News, or, you know, whatever the South Bend newspaper is. People just aren't subscribing to that. Now, that being said, you know, you talk about narratives. This is the Narrative Monopoly podcast, and the micro incentives that are the forcing function of the narrative monopoly are that there is a limited amount of these jobs in the media. And therefore, if you want to climb up the microscopic ladder that there is, or the opportunities are microscopic rather, comparatively to other fields, and you want to be the, you know, White House correspondent for New York Times, I mean, there's only a handful of those positions, right? And so you have to toe the line, you have to comport to the narratives in order to climb up that ladder. What I think is interesting about what you guys are doing is that in terms of story selection and framing and going outside the narrative and really just focusing on what the broader audience wants to hear, is because you guys are not locked into those micro incentives. Your incentive is to simply make the audience happy with your product. I do think that you've been able to achieve what a lot of people have said is impossible, which is like news that is, you know, objective, news that is not raising your blood pressure. So what I'm interested in hearing is, what is your process for story selection? Like, how do you guys actually go through and choose the stories of the day? Because what I'll push back on overall is a lot of the actual on the ground reporting still is being done by people who are in the same exact elite media that you guys want to run oppositional to. So how do you navigate that?
It's a great question. First of all, I think when people say, what is media bias, when you talk about it, what does that look like? I think the number one way it manifests, I would say there are two main areas. One is story selection, and the second is narrative placement or context, where you give a story and then you frame it. You know, and it can happen on the left and the right. For example, on the right, it could be, you could have a story about unemployment, and then the next paragraph is, you know, 600,000 migrants have illegally crossed the border in the last few months. And then on the left, it could be, you know, a gun story about, you know, a shooting, and it could be, this is the blank mass shooting. And some of it can be responsible. Some of the context is fair, but it happens in every single story. And so it leaves the reader seeing a story in a given light that the paper picks. And it's usually a light that they shine on every story of that category. On the front of how we pick stories, I think what we look for is here's stories we avoid, because selection is more, I think, weeding out than like saying, hey, we want this. We avoid the DC food fight. If there's some places dwell on, you know, congress people going back and forth, and, you know, the kind of DC pissing match that people hate to watch, we don't cover that. You know, I think unless it's really substantive and it has larger impact, we never cover the trivial reality show aspect of DC that other places love and that gets clicks, by the way, but we think long term it waters down a brand and a news experience. We cover stories that we think are most interesting to people, and we scour the internet. We have software programs that do a really good job of skimming all our top news sources to see what's relevant. We love to go primary source. We're always looking for new data, and we have a number of ways we find that new data, and new public polling, new research, all that sort of thing, so that you can kind of cut out the middleman of what you were saying of who's doing the reporting. But there's no question that we're still relying on some reporting of these established outlets whose overall news coverage we don't love. But a lot of it is, you know, these are obvious stories and there's nothing exclusive. I think a lot of times the reporting that people say, you know, the capital J journalism, it's really just, it's stories that are already given to you and they just find, you know, they're doing like investigative quote gathering and there's no sense of this is exclusive to them, especially with social media and podcasts. We found, Jeff, that a ton of stories come straight from someone's social media feed or from podcasts, or that's how stories are leaked. So there's almost been a democratization of information that's relevant to news. So we don't feel like we're just curators, although we think curation is as important as ever in balancing out sources from both sides. So it sounds very broad to say we try to pick out the most interesting and relevant to the average people. But I think in practice, there are so many stories like today in our newsletter we cover, casinos have a record story. Reforestation the size of France has taken place over the last 20 years. We cover a story on billionaires like Peter Thiel backing a new crypto exchange that has $10 billion in capitalization. These are some stories that are interesting to people, that are relevant to our target audience and aren't covered as heavily by the New York. Oh, and also the CDC about outdoor transmission of COVID. The CDC labeled it as less than 10% of cases are transmitted outside. It turns out that it's less than 1% or even less than 0.1%. So we just want to, you know, communicate that's relevant to people, right? Every day they make decisions on whether to wear a mask. So I don't want to ramble, but yeah.
We'll get back on this, but give me the stat that you gave me before we hit record around the 40%.
Oh, it's 40% of millennials have changed pant sizes during the pandemic. It's more interesting. We saw this a little bit ago. Of the millennials who've had unwanted weight gains, which is I think like 20%, so it's no small percent of the millennial population, the average weight gain was I think 40 pounds. So of that like one fifth to one quarter, the average was 40 pounds. So, and there was, by the way, as much smaller percentage of millennials who had unwanted weight losses, but it was just unbelievable. That story is interesting to me. I mean, you want to talk about relevant to everyday life and interesting, that's not going to get a lot of coverage, but I thought that was crazy.
Well, I mean, as you know, I'm no fan of kind of like the traditional framing of a lot of just traditional issues in terms of health. I think that COVID, what it's really done is shined a light on, in my opinion, the epidemic of obesity and how pernicious it is in American life. I think it is a crisis that if we were a rational society, all of the alarm bells would be going off. And I mean, if you look, so the CDC came out and said it was 75% roughly of the patients who were hospitalized over the last year for COVID, at 50% were obese and then additional 25% were overweight. So, I mean, that is just a massive number, 75%. That means that if you were in shape, you were very unlikely to go to the hospital. And then you can obviously get into the fact that there is a fast food restaurant on every corner. The fact that, you know, there's all this artificial sugar and everything. It's such a crisis. And then the people who want to push back on that, who are like, oh, you're just fat shaming. No, I'm not fat shaming at all. I want, you know, someone who I care about who is overweight to get in shape, so therefore I can enjoy them as a friend or loved one for a longer period because they will live longer. And by the way, they will be happier. And the United States spends so much goddamn money on healthcare because everyone is fat. Like, that's the reality that you're just not allowed to say, but it's so true. And it's just wild.
Fat shaming is interpersonal and it's a version of bullying where you specifically target an individual and you somehow degrade them for
their... Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, that's bad. Facts about health are not fat shaming. The idea that... And the one irony I think I've mentioned on my personal Twitter, which is where I sometimes bend, because we try to keep it so down the middle, so fact-oriented, that sometimes I have things I you know, you kind of want to... That you don't want your opinion to spill in. So sometimes I've been on Twitter, although I just deleted the app and the phone because Twitter just can be so toxic. But the CDC recommends that people have no more than 200 calories worth of sugar in a given day. Most Americans hit that by lunch. That's one soda.
Jeez.
So it's also interesting that they've ignored how obesity's played into the pandemic, which is undeniable. And one thing that is scary about the stats you shared about 50% obesity, 25% overweight for the hospitalized COVID cases, that actually doesn't deviate that much from the already existing national percentages. It's worse, but it already shows how bad we are. So it adds to the risk, but it also shows this is our fabric. It's not like these people are, and you look at some of the countries that have fared best on percentage on fatality of hospitalized cases, and the countries that are lowest in obesity top that list. So I think what comes to my mind is, why are we hiding from this? Well, I understand a lot of the countries bad. It's a difficult issue. It's a self-esteem issue for many, but is that really what's preventing us from telling the truth? And by the way, what would help people lead healthier, happier lives and longer lives? Why are we hiding from it? I think that question a lot of people on a personal basis are believed, but they're afraid to say. Do you have thoughts on that? Like, why do people not talk about this?
Well, I think that there's a narrative monopoly on it, that you're just mean if you bring it up. And I think that's not true. I think that we can do two things at once. Two things can be true at once. And I think those two things are to destigmatize that it is a bad thing to talk about, and also make sure that, in the same way that I think a lot of schools and movements and I guess celebrities have done a great job of stigmatizing bullying in schools, we should, at the same time we say it's not okay to be in this unhealthy of a state, we should also say, if you make fun of these people, then you will be tarred and feathered socially, because it should just be like the most unacceptable thing to make fun of people who are overweight, because it should be just like the great, like you see someone, dude, whenever I see someone overweight who's working out and just like sweating like a madman, that fires me up, because I'm like, this person fucking rocks. Like, they are 100%. Getting after it. Like, I love that. And we should just 100%. Encourage that.
And I think that combination would actually encourage more people to lose weight when you're honest about, when you're honest about, okay, as Michael Pollan, author of Omnivore Dilemma, said, heart disease is the most avoidable killer in America today. And it's a cause of our diet and lack of exercise. So if you're just honest about, you know, here are the consequences of being obese, but never bully. That to me would encourage so many people to do what you're doing. Cause I think right now we're in this odd place where people are afraid to talk about obesity honestly. And it's almost created a subculture of people with resentment toward those who are keeping you from talking about obesity. And they're like, you know, there's almost more anger because they're like, this is such an obvious issue we need to talk about. You're not letting people talk about it because you think that equates to fat shaming. But I think the healthy balance is exactly what you said: discourage, stigmatize the bullying, and be honest and help people with their health by being honest about obesity. And one thing that, you know, with the recent menthol and flavored cigarillo ban that's underway, it's like, to me, I get that. But then I'm walking out of, you know, a DC metro, and you walk past Krispy Kreme, and there's someone double fisting donuts with a large bottle of Coke in their hands. And it's like, you want to see proven health consequences about what this lifestyle leads, just like smoking menthol cigarettes will do. I think, like, you know, I don't think anybody would say that's tobacco shaming to say smoking's bad. And I think we shouldn't call it fat shaming to say, you know, overindulging in donuts and sodas bad.
Yeah, that's a great point. I do think the one caveat is where I think that if someone was listening in on this and they were trying to play devil's advocate, what they'd probably say to us is, okay, you know, some people are big boned, of a bigger frame. And that is, like, you know, that's the thing where, you know, that should not be stigmatized either. Everybody's got, you know, a different frame, a different chassis that they're running on. And, I think that would be just like nitpicking, but overall it's a huge issue that I wish that, you know, everyone, it was kind of like a team effort in America. I think we're on board here with that.
100%. I mean, everybody, you know, I think everybody has a different starting point, and there's no question, just like on every issue, everyone has a different baseline for, you know, let's say something like anger. You know, some people are more prone to anger and being aggressive. Like, that's a personality trait. So, but it doesn't mean, you know, you shouldn't discourage overly aggressive behavior. And I think, you know, and that itself might be an aggressive analogy. I apologize to anybody who's offended by that. But here's the average. We're not dealing, though, with a country that's like 2 pounds overweight. You want to know what the average weight of a male is in this country? 191 pounds. The average weight of a male in France and Japan, don't hold me to this one, but I want to say it's in the low 160s. So we're already, and by the way, the average height of a, or I can't remember, if it, no, it's average. Not median, is 5'9", almost on the dot. So it's 5'9", 190 pounds. So I think that question of, like, the devil advocate's point about, well, you know, some people's biology isn't as favorable to being skinny. That's 100% true. But we're not dealing with a couple pounds this country needs to lose on average. We're dealing with much more than that. And by the way, it would lead to great family, social, and economic outcomes. That's what I think is the story that needs to be told. There's a happy story. It's not just angry people saying, don't eat that double cheeseburger. It's people saying, this will make your life better. I think if we just change the language so it's less angry, more honest and scientific and positive, that would just benefit everybody.
So it's just a big group hug is what we need.
Yeah, we need a big group hug. Yeah. And Jeff, I've got to say, I can't be too critical. My belt was feeling a little tight today, so maybe I need to change pant sizes. I'm not aggressive people.
There you go. It's good firsthand reporting from
exactly.
Max.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, one thing that's actually interesting is as a little offshoot here is, if I'm starting to get into this a little bit more is, and I want to do one, but if you look at, Iron Man, like if you look at a lot of pictures from Iron Man, a lot of these triathletes are, they don't look like super skinny, like marathoners are super skinny. But if you get to the triathlete part, you start putting on more pounds because you have to just eat so much food. You have to just consume calories like crazy. It's the same concept as like offensive linemen who run like 4.7s. You know, that's just how you're built because you do that. It's pretty cool.
Have you seen, it's unbelievable. A guy like Myles Garrett, I hate to give a shout out to.
He's a freak. Defense,
but he with this, you know, he's, I don't know, he's like 270, 280, maybe.
Yeah.
And he has a six pack. It's like elongated, but that's how strong he simply has to pack more weight on. And I do want to give one more point on the obesity subject. I think the obnoxious health freaks are hurting any progress on this issue. The CrossFit types who are constantly broadcasting yeah. their workouts and those who are always talking about their, you know, their latest diet. I think that also, let's be real, that this isn't a good guy versus bad guy thing. I think it's everybody, you know, we're working together. That's so cheesy, the kumbaya message. But at the same time, it's like, don't represent a healthy lifestyle so poorly. And nobody cares about your new CrossFit gym membership.
Well, I think the funny thing around all of those, I don't want to call them fads, but just different niches within the, you know, health community, whether it's diet or workout, is
it really doesn't take much to be relatively healthy. I mean, it takes eating a good diet. It takes sleeping at least 7 hours a night. And then I think, you know, sweating for 30 minutes a day is like the baseline. Like if you do those three things, you'll be set. The one thing, and I think that David Goggins is like, he's like the extreme version of this, but he's a great inspiration. I think, you know, and we've been on this tangent for a while now, but there is also a fiduciary crisis. And this reminds me of it because the fiduciary crisis is we have, you know, Yuval Levin's on this podcast. I think he's going to come out before this, the episode. You know, the institutions are just simply not doing what they are supposed to do in terms of just aligning themselves towards their stated goals. And a great example of this is Pepsi. So Pepsi runs ads about how all of their buildings that they're in are like climate efficient or whatever, which, sure, that's great. It has absolutely no tangible impact on the actually reducing carbon in the grand scheme of things. But sure, you want to tell us you're green? That's great. How about you stop giving all of America diabetes? Like that is what you could do. You could work in your lab and in your R&D facilities and figure out a way to create Pepsi without giving everyone diabetes. That would actually do a lot more than the virtue signaling ads about, you know, your LED or lead, whatever it's called, building. Like it's crazy.
Well, this is why I don't think our tangent on health, American health, is much of a tangent. I think it's directly related to the narrative problem in the country where you have mainstream media, which I don't even love that term. I like to say legacy news media because everybody hears mainstream and they're like, you know, and it becomes immediately political because that's a pejorative that's used. But I think just the idea of legacy news media companies who don't tell the truth on some very important issues like health. And it almost makes people more skeptical broadly of information in the country when something that's so obvious, something you see with your eyes all day long, isn't being reported or ever talked about. And on the Pepsi front, you see this happen all the time where it's Amazon will talk about supporting workers and then, you know, stories come out about their warehouse worker conditions. Or Nike or Disney's a better example, virtue signal about how inclusive their new ride is at Disney World. And then you'll find out that they don't put African-American movie characters on posters in China and they film Mulan, live action Mulan in the concentration camp province of China. And there are just so many obvious contradictions with themselves. And you point out Pepsi's contradiction. And it's almost comical that people fall for it. And I think that's one reason we're motivated. Roka isn't, our job isn't calling out hypocrisy. Our job, because we think there are some places that just add to the toxicity when you do engage in this fight of like point, counterpoint, argument,
yeah,
argument.
100%.
We don't want to be the other side. We aren't the other side. In fact, there's no side that's in the back of our minds that we're trying to be a foil to. We aren't that at all. We simply think news should not conform to any narrative. News should be interesting. News shouldn't be a chore. News shouldn't be alarmist. And so these companies, we don't want to be the place that looks at Pepsi and goes, hey, Pepsi, you're really helping out the environmental issue? Really? Really? You know, you feed people 1.8 times what they should be eating on a normal daily basis. And that exhausts resources far more than your green friendly buildings will ever save. So your net positive impact is actually non-existent and negative. So we don't want to be the place that points that out. That's not part of anything you do. Go.
The energy, I'm sorry, I'm obsessed with this. The energy on the in the hospitals that care for the people who need to be hospitalized because of complications from drinking the sugar water probably produces more carbon than what is saved from
that
their building.
Is spot on. Or the amount of, because some of their products are addicting, and the amount of environmental waste that goes into making Pepsi and their fountain drinks is far more. So like, there's no sense of what's your net pot. Okay. We get, and the scary thing is, Jeff, because of how effective advertising is, a lot of people would look at Pepsi and in their mind, consciously or subconsciously, there's that green triangle symbol that pops into their head and like, Pepsi's one of the good guys. Really? Are they? Your point right there is spot on about, you know, the actual reality of their environmental impact, not what they put on a brochure or a digital ad. So 100%. And I think, you know, I think there's just got to be more people who don't subscribe to a virtue signaling environment, but instead are more interested in the plain spoken truth and not, you know, disingenuous pats on the back.
So would it be fair to say that if you want to, as a news consumer, if you want to opt out from a lot of the everything that we just talked about in regards to the media, and you just want to be informed and you just want non-biased, entertaining information, informative information, that's what Roke is going for?
Everything you just said is spot on. If you compare our Instagram news top four stories that we give every single day and that have become a huge hit and have vibrant comment sections, the engagement is, we'll get now more likes and comments than companies like The Economist, Wall Street Journal, NPR. NPR's engagement's good, but we'll often beat them, not just in percentage numbers, we far blow them out of the water, but in terms of gross likes and comments on Instagram, because I think we do give people what you described of non-biased, straight up, interesting, entertaining news that leaves people feeling better every single day. We talk about the health issue on this podcast, Jeff. What people don't talk about is the impact on mental health that alarmist negative partisan news has every single day. It's sending people through the roof. It's sending people through the roof for needless reasons, for narratives, not truth, for narratives. It's one thing if we were in the throes of World War II and the truth and reality. I mean, COVID's been terrible. Does that mean you need a death tracker every day? And every time there's an anecdote of a 35-year-old who dies, even though that represents 0.00% of 35-year-old cases, does that mean that anecdote is relevant to your life? No, it's not. And it needlessly causes stress. But to go back to a point, if you look at our Instagram, and by the way, every day, our most popular podcast, our product is called a Roka Wrap, which is a deep dive on an interesting topic any day, whether that's AI facial recognition, whether that's about this new Kentucky Derby trainer who's had 5 drug infractions this past year, or today it's on this patch of highway. You could theoretically take a road trip from Alaska to the coast to Argentina because it's continuous, but there's a patch of highway that is overrun by criminals and dangerous wildlife. And we talk about that it's right between Panama and Colombia. So there are all these interesting stories we cover. And if you compare that to what the New York Times, CNN, NPR, Fox, New York Post puts on their front page, it is far more enjoyable and less narrative advancing and alarmist.
Yeah, I love that. I think I've said this many times. I think we should ban cable news, but I would settle for a Surgeon General's warning.
That is the truth. If you had every time you get a pack of cigarettes or a bottle of booze, there's going to be Surgeon. That should be on the front page of some of these news outlets. They have the same negative impact. I bet if you quantified all health impact for what people consume on a daily basis, I bet that's right up there in terms of negative impact.
100%. All right, let's just give me the kind of the background and thought process around, you know, you guys had like a full platform site and then your Instagram page took off and you saw it as kind of the golden goose for distribution. So I know we got to get you out of here soon. Let's get that story real quick.
100%. So we start off as with the mission of reaching young people with quality, non-biased, entertaining news. And that was our mission that inspired us, all three of us founders, Billy, Max Frost, and myself to quit our jobs. And early on, we mistakenly, despite the research and our intuitions, and for kind of conventional reasons, we were like, okay, we have to have a website. Even though we knew we don't use news websites. I mean, we do because we're avid news consumers, but our peers don't use websites, and social media is the best way to reach people. And specifically within the ecosystem of social media, Instagram is the best place to reach people. And there aren't any social media first serious news companies out there. There's not one that recognizes that Instagram is the best way to reach people aged 18 to 32. So as things went on, we were like, let's do a really high quality Instagram news product. And it took off starting in January. And we went from 2,000 followers to last night, we hit 300,000. And we've just had tremendous growth. People love what we're doing. And that made us think, who are we? Why have a website? Why? Because news competitors who we're trying to beat and whose model we hate have websites? Why do we have one? So we just decided to get rid of it and go social media first, and also the newsletter, because email is universal. The problem with social media is you still have people, you know, even within a specific demographic, not everybody conforms to the same social media habits. So you'll have some people who prefer Snapchat, some people prefer YouTube, which for whatever reason is classified as social media now. Some people prefer TikTok, Facebook. Go down the line. So we said, forget website. Website's only good because it's a vehicle for reaching the masses. But if the masses that we want to reach aren't on websites anymore, let's find where they are. And that's Instagram.
That's
great. So we went all Instagram. And last thing I'll say is you got to do a product that's native to that platform. For Instagram, it's got to be very visual, graphically appealing. And that was a big learning curve. And I think we're in a really good spot now.
Yeah, I will say I do appreciate the pictures that are on there. Yeah. I read all the words, but the pictures draw me in. All right, well, I'll give you the floor to close here with anything you'd like to say about Notre Dame football
next season. Jeff, first of all, thank you so much for having me on, and this podcast, I feel that we are kindred spirit and mission here. So I love what you're doing, and Notre Dame football is a great subject to close on because it is also victim of false narratives. It's also victim of false narratives. You have everybody, oh, Notre Dame can't win big games, really? Well, the two best championship teams, two of the three or four best of the last 20 years, I'll put 2006 Texas in there, maybe 2001 Miami, but and maybe 2019 LSU. Yeah, we'll put them in there. So two of the top were 2018 Clemson and 2020 Bama. Okay, Notre Dame plays both. We get blown out by both. We lose by 20, and we lose 30-3 in 2018 to Clemson, which is less than Clemson beat Alabama by in that championship game. And then this past year, we lose to, I'm sorry to bring up Ohio State's terrible loss, we lose to Alabama by less than Ohio State lost to in the championship game. So we were victims of awful team. We made the playoffs two of the last 3 years. Notre Dame's going to the moon. Call it right now. We're in the playoffs again. That's all I got.
All right. I mean, those are some college football narratives. That's a good good rebuttal, I guess. I think most people would just say that you did lose. So that's kind of what's on paper. But
look, I will say this: I don't like to talk about the fact that they were 27 and 28 point losses. I just want to push back a little bit on a narrative.
That's fair. Who's the new quarterback?
Well, it was going to be this Wisconsin transfer who's kind of boring guy, Jack Cohn, but it might be our freshman named Tyler, who had the best blue and gold spring game performance. So he's a stud out of California, Originally 5-star, now 4-star, but I think he'll be really good.
Yeah, it's nice of Ian Book to leave after his 8th year as quarterback.
He was getting, I think when they saw the gray hairs come in, they were like, Ian, you got to go to the league. And now he's on the Saints.
Ah, there you go. All right. Well, I really enjoyed this, Max. So I appreciate it. And everyone should go check out at Ride the News on Instagram or go to RokanNews.com and sign up for the newsletter, if that's correct.
That's correct, Jeff. Thank you so much. Really appreciate this. This was so much fun. And I will continue. You know, I hope this is a dialogue between us, and I think we're up to something similar. So I really appreciate it. And we need more of us. So everybody listening there, you know, the way it is, isn't the way it has to be. And we want to change that.
Totally agree. Totally agree. It's a long slog, but we'll get there.
Absolutely. All right, Jeff, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Max.
And there you have it. That was the episode with Max. Please go follow at Ride the News on Instagram. If you're not sold, I don't know what to tell you, but you should be sold. Go follow them right now, and we will see you next week.